This panel features an article titled What Climate Change Can Do About Tort Law, and it's written by Professor Doug Kaiser. My name is Blake Barnes, and as an article editor for LPAR, it has been an honor to work with Professor Kaiser on this fine panel, who I will now introduce. Professor Kaiser is Deputy Dean and Joseph M. Field Professor of Law at Yale Law School, where he teaches and researches in areas including torts, environmental law, and risk regulation. He has published in many areas and is a co-author of a leading case book, The Torts Process. He also has a recent book titled Regulating from Nowhere, Environmental Law and the Search for Objectivity, which seeks to reinvigorate environmental law and policy by offering novel theoretical insights on cost-benefit analysis, the precautionary principle, and sustainable development. First up of our commenters is James Anderson, who works for RAND and the Institute for Civil Justice on lots of very interesting issues. Prior to his current position, Mr. Anderson practiced criminal law in Pennsylvania and clerked for the Honorable Morton Greenberg on the Third Circuit. He has published on a variety of topics on both civil and criminal law, and including very pertinent for today, the way in which that economic analysis of tort law is indeterminate with respect to the set of inputs it considers. To Mr. Anderson's left is Mr. David Doniger, who is a policy director and senior attorney for the NRDC's Climate and Clean Air Program. Mr. Doniger has represented NRDC in many clean air cases, including Massachusetts versus EPA, and he leads the NRDC lawsuits, he leads the NRDC legal team helping defend EPA's initial carbon pollution standards against the industry-led lawsuits and legislative attacks. Prior to NRDC, Mr. Doniger worked in the Clinton administration primarily as director of climate change policy at EPA. To Mr. Doniger's left is Ms. Ellen Peter, who came all the way from California, where she is chief counsel of the California Air Resources Board. Notably, in May 2009, Ms. Peter helped negotiate the landmark deal announced by the White House for the first set of national vehicle greenhouse gas emission standards. And prior to joining the Air Resources Board, Ellen worked for more than 20 years for the California Attorney General, where during 2006-2008, she headed the legal team that defended California's vehicle greenhouse gas emission standards against the auto industry's attacks in federal and state court. Last but not least on the end is Mr. David Buente, who is the head of Sidley Austin's environmental group and represents clients in complex environmental litigation. His long list of clients includes the biggest names in international business, a few of which are Duke Energy, ExxonMobil, GE, and Ford Motors. Mr. Buente joined Sidley Austin in 1990 from the U.S. Department of Justice, where he was the Chief of Environmental Enforcement. So without further ado, thank you very much to you all for being here, and I will turn it over to Professor Kaiser.
Well, first, obviously, I'd like to thank ELI and Vanderbilt for putting together this event. I'm really proud to be a part of this tradition. I'd also like to thank the commentators for being here and for drafting up the comments that I was able to preview last night on the train ride down from New Haven. And I was so impressed by the sharpness and the importance of the questions that were raised in those comments, I've decided to change my plan for this little presentation. I had a fancy PowerPoint with lots of multimedia, and I was gonna just kind of dazzle you with shock and awe. And instead, I think I wanna keep my remarks really brief and to the point so that we can have lots of time for back and forth and interaction. I just wanna describe what I was up to in this paper as succinctly as I can do. The paper actually was written for an annual lecture series that the Lewis and Clark Law School holds out in Portland, Oregon each year. And it's a lecture series where when I went back and I looked at how previous environmental law scholars had used this platform, they had used it in what might seem to be a kind of academically self-indulgent way. They'd used it as an opportunity to engage in kind of more speculative, big think kinds of writings, where their writing was meant to be kind of deliberately thought-provoking, take a traditional kind of well-understood policy narrative or a policy framework, and just try to turn it inside out, just to open up new questions, new ranges of possibility. And so I wanted to try to follow in their footsteps, and I chose to look at the climate change nuisance suits that, at least back at that time, were still percolating pretty actively through the federal courts. Now we're kind of down to Kivalina and maybe Comer limping along on life support after the Supreme Court's Connecticut versus AEP decision last summer. But at the time, everybody was naturally writing about and thinking about what potential climate change nuisance suits would have as a vehicle for helping to address the greenhouse gas problem. There was a range of views in the literature, some folks saying tort is a great vehicle for challenging climate change, others saying this is a terrible fit. I wasn't really interested in that question. I wanted to instead turn it around and ask, well, what might climate change do to the tort system? In other words, if climate change scientists are right about the sheer number and intensity of harms that we're likely to suffer over the course of the next century, what might that changing economic, social, and environmental context mean for tort law and for the judges who hear cases that are brought before them? So in the first part of the article, I laid out my view on the merits of the climate change nuisance suits, and my view, somewhat regrettably, was that there's about a dozen different ways in which those suits are likely almost certain to fail on their merits. If the tort paradigm is A hits B, then climate change is about as far removed from that paradigm as one can possibly get. Climate change is a wrong in which all of us are both simultaneously victims and polluters. In the second, and I think more important part of the paper, I asked what might the continual effects and impacts of climate change, including those impacts that are brought before courts as an alleged wrong for which compensation ought to be owed, what might that do to the tort system itself? And there I engaged in a very speculative exercise about asking how might our traditional understandings of duty and breach and causation and harm, how might they be affected by the way in which climate changes our thought processes, right? Our thought processes about things like relationality. Do we start to understand a greater geographic scope of potential causal relations when we start to realize that everything we're doing every day is contributing to a phenomenon that's binding together the entire planet into a collective action nightmare, right? When that finally starts to sink into our public consciousness and into the consciousness of our judges, might that affect how they approach more garden variety pollution problems, right? And I did a series of exercises like that for causation, for cognizable categories of damages, and a whole range of other aspects of the tort field. Now, what this argument was not is important. It was not an exercise in prediction. I certainly didn't mean to say I think this is how judges will in fact cope with and evolve over the course of the next century. Because that kind of, I mean, that would just be silly to try to make a prediction with that many indeterminate variables over that long of a time horizon. What it was intended to be was an exercise in scenario analysis. It was meant to be a fairly richly described account of a possible future jurisprudential world, right? One in which one can imagine, given where we are now, that the judicial system might evolve to that point, right? And in doing so, it makes it open for us to consider whether that would be a normatively desirable evolution. It was also not an exercise in prescription. It's not a proposal. I wasn't proposing that judges do this or that thing. I was trying to lay out the various concepts and considerations that go into whether judges will evolve in one direction or another. Now, it's fairly obvious, like, from the tone and from my other writings, where I believe, like, I do believe it would be normatively desirable if we expand our notion of duty to encompass a broader range of temporal and geographic concerns. I do think it would be valuable if judges would modernize their understandings of causation to include everything that science has taught us for the last 200 years. But that was neither here nor there, really, into what the ambition of the project was. Irrespective of whether judges do evolve in that manner, there's an independent benefit simply in having an official locus within our governmental system where unaddressed harms are brought and where there is an official representative of our polity who has to give an answer, who has to say, yes, you've been wronged, or no, you have not been wronged, and moreover, has to give a reasoned answer. All right, so to really lay out what I was trying to do in this paper, I also have to tell you about a second paper, and this brings me back to Mike's caution this morning that we academics, we indulge in lengthy articles at the risk of relevance. So here I am telling you, not only did I have one long paper, but there's a second long paper that really needs to be understood. But in the second paper, a paper that was called Prods and Pleas, Limited Government in an Era of Unlimited Harm, in this paper, I was arguing that various preliminary hurdles to merits adjudication that have been put in the way of these climate change nuisance suits, hurdles like political question doctrine or standing doctrine, I argued that those hurdles should not be imposed as barriers to the merits adjudication of these suits, even though I'm also on record as saying on the merits I think these suits will lose. And the reason why is that those doctrines are public law doctrines. They evolved and they were designed to deal with the problem of citizen suit challenges to the actions of a very complex administrative state. And it reflects the court's reluctance to be dragged too deeply into the separation of powers battles that go on between Congress and the executive. And in fact, the doctrine of standing came from the private law of tort. If we look at its elements, they are drawn from classical tort law doctrine. So to fold those elements back on top of tort law itself is conceptually confusing and I think just entirely unnecessary. Now, but why do scholars and judges nevertheless gravitate towards these doctrines? Why do they try to use these doctrines as their kind of Hail Mary way of avoiding what seems to be a politically radioactive case? Well, I think they do because, in part, they misunderstand tort law as a regulatory device. They see tort law the way that the legal realists like Holmes did, or the law and economics scholars like Judge Posner do, or the way that some progressive judges like Roger Trainer from the California Supreme Court did. They view tort as a kind of pseudo-regulatory device that's supposed to internalize externalities and do things like solve the climate change problem. And I just think that's a terribly historically misinformed way to think about the tort system. The tort system has always been a private law system. It's a system of redressing personal wrongs that are done between a particular plaintiff A and a particular defendant B. And it's a private wrong that needs to be corrected by bringing it before a neutral arbiter. And I think that remains emphatically a private law system, even in the context of a case like Kivalina, where we have a many thousand-year-old Inuit Eskimo tribe that's bringing an alleged harm before a court that it claims has been perpetrated by a dozen or so fossil fuel companies. Even in that context, it's not a regulatory agenda that's being pursued, it's a private law action that's being pursued. And again, the reason why that's important is that judges have to answer. The village of Kivalina will have to be given an answer. That's a unique aspect of the tort system. It's not found in other aspects of our government. I call Senator Inhofe's office all the time to update him on the latest climate sciences, and he never returns my calls. I also think, and this is a subtle point, but I think it's an important one, the wide availability of the tort system, the openness of the tort system to the airing of grievances, even grievances that scholars like myself think will likely fail in the merits, that helps our system of limited government remain as thin as it does. It helps us have a thinner system of government because there is a residual place that we can go when agencies, Congress, and other branches are not dealing with harms that are starting to loom on the horizon. So that's all I'll say because I'm really anxious to hear from these great commentators.
Thanks. I also wanted to introduce Quinn Sorensen and Clayton Northhouse, who are actually the real authors of most of what I peddle in the public domain on this. We can move, I think, pretty quickly through this. I wanted to start with, for the people who are not mavens in this area, just a brief recap of the existing litigation, climate change, common law cases. There are four nuisance cases that were all styled initially as federal common law public nuisance cases, as well as some alleged state claims. The net result at this point is that all four of the cases have been dismissed. Of course, the Supreme Court ruled in American Electric Power that a lawsuit brought by the states and some private land trusts, that the federal common law at least was displaced by the Clean Air Act's authorization to US EPA to regulate greenhouse gases. The Kivalina case, which is brought by an Alaskan Native village against some of the oil companies and electric utilities, that was dismissed by the district court and it is currently pending before the Ninth Circuit. The Comer case has now been dismissed twice, the second time around by the judge in the Southern District of Mississippi. He listed approximately 10 grounds for dismissal, including some of the doctrines that we just heard about, political question standing, displacement, preemption of state law, and even got into some of the substantive nuisance issues. And then finally, there was the lawsuit that California brought against the five major auto manufacturers that was dismissed. That case was then essentially settled, as I understood it, as part of the arrangement that was made amongst the federal government, the state of California, and the industry during the aftermath of 2008. And part of that arrangement involved the industry agreeing that it would not oppose California's greenhouse gas regulatory program for motor vehicles. And then the nuisance case was also dismissed. There's another area that is common law, and I'd say pretty analogous to what we're talking about today, and that is the public trust doctrine cases. There's been a lawsuit filed that's now pending here in D.C. on behalf of a half dozen teenagers, hence the name Alec L., because they're appearing as through guardian ad litem, and a couple of NGOs against six of the executive branch agencies, including EPA, arguing that under the public trust doctrine, the federal government has an obligation to manage the resources of the United States, including the atmosphere, so as to abate global warming by drastically curtailing greenhouse gas emissions. And then there are a battery of similar cases that have been brought and or rulemaking petitions lodged against every one of the 50 state governments. The case is now pending here. The motions to dismiss by both the federal government and interveners representing industry will be argued May 11th in the district court here. Several of the state cases have been dismissed and are now on appeal. There's three state courts, Supreme Courts, that will be hearing the appeals in the next year or so. I think we can move through. We've already heard what Professor thinks of what the nature of a tort is and really pretty much move on to our three comments. This is where we think the problems are with the idea that climate change should produce a whole new species of tort. Conceptually, we think that the basic principles of separation of powers, which are embedded obviously in our federalist system in the United States Constitution, and by and large have been adopted at the state level, present basic obstacles to having climate change solved by judges who in the federal system are unelected, life tenured. And as the Supreme Court observed, 8-0 in the AEP case, are not particularly well equipped to handle and address the myriad policy questions that you have to wrestle with to decide how much should the emissions be reduced, by whom, under what circumstances, and who's going to pay for all of that. There's a second question that is more or less related to separation of powers, but I guess we've called it fundamental fairness. Historically, tort law has been about A versus B, and it's been tweaked from time to time to accommodate things like products liability cases where people are injured by products produced 3,000 or in these days and times 10,000 miles away. And the judges employing common law, tort law, have found ways to accommodate that. But the basic principle that you pay damages for injuries to others when you are the actor that has caused them, and only you are the actor that has caused them, is embedded in the whole idea of tort law. And to shift to a system that essentially says that anyone who has any contribution of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere certainly risks creating a system of great unfairness, because you can have cases and tort against people who have emitted very small amounts many years ago, or maybe very small amounts currently, being faced with damage claims by people potentially all over the world. Our legal system has embraced the notion of joint and several liability, for sure, in what some may say is an analogous circumstance. My favorite analogy here is the Superfund program, where the United States Congress in 1980, in order to clean up hazardous waste disposal around the country, enacted a program that included the principle of joint and several liability for anybody who had contributed to a release of hazardous substances. But again, we're talking about specific locations, specific events in time, and a true causal linkage, if you will, between the injury that someone's complaining of and the action by the defendant. Finally, and I've already alluded to this, is the problem of the judiciary really not being very well equipped to do this. It's a play really further on the fairness problem. The United States District Court judges and the state trial court judges simply are not going to have jurisdiction over most of the emitters. They're not going to be able, and people aren't going to be able to bring into the United States judicial system the emitters who are in Asia and Africa and Latin America. And going forward, that's where most of the emissions are now occurring and surely are going to be occurring in the future. Many of the emitters and the larger ones in Asia and the other continents are state-owned enterprises. They're, for example, extensions of the Chinese government. And the Chinese government is not going to agree to submit its enterprises to the jurisdiction of the United States courts so that people can be sued over carbon dioxide emissions. Similarly, the state courts are generally not allowed to entertain lawsuits involving foreign entities as well. And there's another limitation in that the state courts are not supposed to, states are generally not allowed to impose their laws on the conduct and actions of people in other states, let alone foreign countries. So we see that as being sort of really basic problem to doing this. What this leads us to ultimately is to say that the problem really is one that requires legislative solution. As unhappy as that may now appear, it's going to take the United States Congress in conjunction with many other countries to do this. If there's going to be a scheme for compensating people who are victims of it, it's going to require some sort of international legal regime that provides for an administrative vehicle, whether it's a quasi-judicial model or something else, in order to address this. So those are the basic thoughts.
Thank you, Dave.
I could use James's slides here.
The problem with the situation in terms of control of greenhouse gases is that we're in a deny and delay mode. And this has been the mantra for years with respect to reductions of greenhouse gases. And I agree with Dave that tort lawsuits are a very clumsy tool to get these reductions. But I also think it's quite ironic that in the regulatory measures that have been taken by the federal government, that some of the same defenses that are being that were raised in the tort suits are also now being raised in these challenges to these federal regulations. Not me, my share doesn't matter, this regulation's really not going to affect, you know, the temperature of the world, and the bedrock defense of climate change doesn't really exist. So in these tort defense cases, the industries have turned around, first the auto industries and then in the AEP case, the industrial sector, and said basically, you know, this is the wrong place and we can't really deal with these things and the judges can't do this. In the cases that are currently pending in the DC Circuit, some of these same claims are coming up. I just think it's ironic that we are looking for a legislative solution on one hand and then when we get to the legislative solution or the regulatory solution, that does not exist. So that's just a point that I wanted to make here. There has been some limited improvements over the last few years with respect to climate change emission reductions. The federal government has stepped up. The automakers did 180 degrees and have discovered they can make money selling cars that actually have less emission emission reductions. And then also that it costs consumers much less to operate these vehicles. So those are all, you know, very positive things going forward. Same thing in the private sector. Some companies are stepping up and realizing that because of customer demands or other, that sustainability kind of practices in their own companies are important. So we are making some limited positive steps in that direction. But in my view, to make these emission reductions actually work is we need to have a price signal on carbon. And this morning, different people have talked about that in different kinds of settings. And the question is how to go about doing that. So we need a consistent signal to the market so they can put the money into the innovation. If you could have prizes and that works, you can have grants and that works. But if you have a long-term signal to the market that emission reductions are gonna be, you know, have a reward, we'll be moving in that direction. So in contrast, for the last 40 years, we had oil prices with the barrel price fluctuating wildly. That does not give that, you know, that consistent price signal. And that's one thing that we can, you know, be looking to in terms of putting a price on carbon. Now, tort law could do that by basically causing, you know, fundamental risk to you know, have to pay damages to give that signal. I agree with David that that's, you know, probably not the best way to do it. I think the regulatory legislative approach is better. I just wish that some industries wouldn't talk out of both sides of their mouth. Meanwhile, the harms are increasing dramatically. It was theoretical when we first started doing the greenhouse gas emission litigations back in 2004. It's getting more real. We have extreme weather events that potentially are connected with climate change. We definitely have sea rise increases. We also have sort of unruly rivers connected with the flooding from different precipitation patterns. So we also, you know, have all this going on. From a state point of view, the cities and the states are the ones that are going to have to deal with these kinds of harms. They're the ones whose, you know, airports are getting flooded. The most particular, you know, most vulnerable target at the moment seems to be wastewater treatment plants, and those are being recognized as something that's going to be affected because of the changes from climate change. So in terms of what's our legislative kind of proposal, the suggestion that we wait for Congress to act doesn't really, you know, give me a, you know, warm and fuzzy feeling because I'm not sure that that's going to happen. Political debate has shifted, and so what I think we have to do is, you know, is be realistic here about looking at regulatory measures. If you do look at a legislative approach, what I'd like to do is commend a couple points from the California's law, which is the Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006, commonly known as AB 32. And it has a few points in it that I just wanted to highlight that I think if there is a legislative response at the federal level that we might want to look at. One is a scoping plan kind of approach, which is a survey across the entire spectrum of measures that could be taken and does an analysis of what's capable of being there and kind of identifies the low-hanging fruit as well as a kind of a cross-the-sector approach. The second thing that I think is useful from the California statute is it sets an absolute emissions limit, get to a certain limit by a certain date. And that actually, in the regulatory setting, had a profound effect. It caused one industry to kind of keep their eye out on the other industries, or within a regulation, looking for, you know, where the, you know, who was getting out cheap. So instead of kind of the dive for the bottom, like, I don't want to have the least amount of emission, you know, impositions, regulations imposed on me, and everybody's diving for the bottom. What came up, for example, in the auto situation, when the auto industry in 2006-07 was saying, we don't want to be regulated, it was really interesting that the stationary source, some of the utilities came in and said, wait a minute, if they get out, that means my share is bigger. And that is playing out somewhat in the regulatory framework when you were looking at different kinds of who's the winners and the losers, that instead of everybody trying to escape from reductions, people are keeping an eye on the other folks. So it's just another comment that comes from a legislative format that sets it up where there's an absolute limit. The other thing that I think is important is a performance standard in the regulations, which is something that California has done for a long time, as has the federal agencies, where you aren't basically picking winners and losers, you're setting a standard of what needs to be done. Reduce your carbon intensity of transportation fuels by 10% by 2020. California doesn't care in the low carbon fuel standard how you get there, but that's where we want you to be. And that's something that, if we have a consistent market signal, will take us to that point. So the bottom line, California has been trying a number of different kinds of activities, both in planning, in specific regulatory measures, in these kind of larger themes like the low carbon fuel standard. Our most recent attempts to get into this field is the cap and trade regulation, first auction later this year. So we're moving ahead, and we think that that actually is a way to put the price on carbon. Once again, torts could do it, but also regulations can do it. And I think the latter is the better way to go. But if that falls away, because either someone's successful in amending the Clean Air Act and removing carbon dioxide as a pollutant, as been suggested, or if there has been other adaption kinds of cases, torts are there as the backdrop. I think that is not the way to go. I think California is providing a model of ways of looking at it. If you do decide to go to a legislative solution, or if EPA continues its efforts on the regulatory front. So we are attempting to lead. We keep looking over our shoulder. We don't have a lot of followers yet. But that's something that I think that is a way to go in the future to address this. So we have the tort solution as our backup, but hopefully we don't need to go that route.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to comment on Doug's paper and on the other speakers. I got a look at Doug's ideas last year in the lead up to the Supreme Court briefing of the AP case, and he submitted on behalf of a number of law professors a very good amicus brief in that case. I thought I would take a moment to look back 10 years or so at how we got here. Why did the Connecticut case happen, and why did it come out the way it did? It's closely interwoven, of course, with the Clean Air Act. And back in, if you cast your minds back a dozen years, the beginning of the Bush administration, our community is trying to figure out how we're going to solve this problem. First route in the 90s was an attempt really to go from the outside in, from start with an international agreement and build the domestic apparatus and consensus to implement that agreement. Actually, at points in the 90s that looked like it would work. The first reaction of the Southern Company to the Kyoto Protocol was to salute all the emissions trading architecture in it, and then they sort of changed their tune. Especially after the election in 2000 was called. So early in the last decade, The EPA under the Bush administration slammed the door shut on the Clean Air Act. They said carbon's not a pollutant, the Clean Air Act doesn't apply. Of course, with states and other environmental organizations, we challenged that decision, but from the vantage point of 2003, when we didn't know the outcome of that yet, we were thinking, well, what other strategies could we follow? And if the Clean Air Act did not apply, it seemed quite reasonable to go back to the law, the federal common law doctrines elaborated really 100 years ago in cases like Georgia versus Tennessee Copper. The line that sticks in my mind from that case is the observation that when the states joined the union, they gave up one of the important rights that they would have vis-a-vis international disputes, namely the right to make war on one another over pollution coming across the border or other matters of that kind. And what they gained in return was the right to a federal court resolution of those kinds of disputes. So no Clean Air Act, we're back to that body of law. And it seemed from the Clean Water Act case law, Supreme Court case law from the 70s, as though the Supreme Court recognized that when there weren't federal regulatory options, that body of case law was still alive. So we started off on that path. As you know, we prevailed on the Clean Air Act pathway in Massachusetts. And so it wasn't particularly surprising that the outcome in 2011 in Connecticut versus AEP was that the Supreme Court would say that you can't use that 100-year-old body of case law of tort law because Congress has provided a regulatory pathway. And the Supreme Court gave our side what you might say is the second softest landing that they could give us. The only softer landing that actually we were seeking was a ruling that if the Clean Air Act authority was there but it hadn't been exercised, then the tort law branch would still be live. The Supreme Court ruled that as long as there is because there is Clean Air Act authority, the tort pathway was cut off, at least for a suit in seeking abatement and an injunctive action. And the court, of course, left undecided the question whether there's a federal tort law claim for damages. That's the case in Kivalina. And they also left undecided what state tort law options there might be. And there we have the, you might say, somewhat non-intuitive structure that the federal statutory law specifically preserves the state common law in both the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, probably other statutes too. So if circumstances should warrant it and state claims are brought, they probably follow the pattern of Ouellette, a case in the late 70s, deciding that state court actions could be brought, but you had to sue under the state law of the home state of the polluter's home state. If circumstances call for it, that body, that option, that route is open, and you might see that pursued. I think at this point, as a practical matter, groups like ours, states with whom we are allied, are trying to make the Clean Air Act work. We had really important achievements in the motor vehicle area that Ellen has reviewed, really settling things out very constructively for the period all the way through 2025 if the current proposed regulations are adopted. And you will see a 50% reduction in the carbon emissions of cars built in 2025 compared to the cars of, say, 2008 or 2010. And a doubling of the mileage, and all at a big savings to the owners of those cars. On the stationary source side, things are moving more slowly, but an important milestone was the proposal at the end of March. Actually, it appears in today's Federal Register on Friday the 13th, of the proposed carbon pollution standard for new power plants. And we will be commenting on that. We had a settlement agreement which provides for EPA to adopt standards for new and existing power plants and new and existing oil refineries, two settlement agreements. The agreements are still there. The deadlines haven't been met. The negotiations continue. We will try to get EPA back on the rails to implementing the commitments under those settlement agreements for these two biggest categories of stationary source emissions of carbon pollution. And of course, we need legislation. And it's funny to be talking about that in an office in Congress, and it doesn't seem very possible right now. We're actually quite close to it. I propounded Doniger's law. It's the opposite of Moore's law. Moore's law is that computing speed increases, doubles every 18 months. Doniger's law is that the interval between enactments of the Clean Air Act doubles with each time. So if you do the calculations starting in 1967, you would conclude that we're due for major amendments of the Clean Air Act by 2016. The next cycle, however, is 52 years, and so it's very important to get this one right. And I'd close with just one observation. It really builds on something that Doug has written about and mentioned here today, is to think about tort law as a last resort for unaddressed harms. You know, when people write briefs in these cases, they say, this is for the legislature, this is for the political process, and so on. And the high-minded view of that is the political process works, and if we haven't been able to pass this kind of legislation, it's just not enough work's been done, the issues are not ripe, things just need to cook some more, and so on. But the process is legitimate, it works, and you, the judges, should defer and have faith in that process. The low-minded view of the political process is that we're in a period of capture, corruption, and dysfunction. And it's very difficult to imagine the current Congress passing any kind of legislation, and let alone to solve big problems. And it's very easy for minorities to block action on any subject. If we have a prolonged period of this, I mean, I really think one needs to think about the words failed state. One needs to think about the consequences of dysfunctional government. Go back to what Holmes said in one of those, I guess it was Georgia versus Tennessee or one of those other cases of that vintage. He said that the states, when they joined the Union, they gave up the right to make war on one another, and they got a forum for resolving disputes peacefully. If we don't have successful political mechanisms, then it puts the pressure back on the courts. And if the courts don't answer, it gives the pressure no place to go in the legitimate political system. And that's when you see, in other countries, you see governments break down. You see governments overthrown. You see, and I'm not predicting anything like that here, but what I'm saying is these same pressures are at work here. There is a real and pressing problem. And if government, through capture, dysfunction, corruption, will not respond, at some point that pressure, it just keeps building, and at some point it needs a response. We want legitimate responses. We want legitimate pathways. And I am 1,000% committed to passing legislation on climate change by 2016, in accordance with Doniger's law, and to making the Clean Air Act, the law we have today, work. And if necessary, going back under the residual theories in state law and the other options that may still be open in the courts. But we have to have an answer. This problem, the physics of this are physical laws of this are strong and unbreakable and demand an answer. Thank you. Thank you.
So this is should work. All right. So first, I wanted to thank everyone for being here and for giving me the opportunity to address this really interesting and extremely thought-provoking paper. So I'm going to just present a slightly more conventional presentation. Doug's very engaging paper notes that climate change faces considerable doctrinal hurdles. I think he does a terrific job of outlining those. He powerfully criticizes tort law's marginalist bias. I'm going to talk at some length about that in a couple minutes, and then suggest that the tort doctrine will evolve to grapple with sort of longer-term problems. And the underlying sort of logic of this argument, I think, is that, I also don't want to. Doug mentioned that he sort of viewed this, I think, appropriately, a sort of imaginative scenario, and I want to critique it sort of in that same light, in the sense of, in some ways, you can consider sort of a part of that sort of scenario analysis in terms of trying to weigh different likelihoods. Because at some level, I mean, I think, you know, part of our what we are doing is there is a predictive element in trying to think about what is likely to come. So I am going to take as a descriptive claim the argument that essentially will climate change sort of cure tort law of this marginalist bias. I think this has some logic in the idea that because of climate change and climate change claims are so so potentially vast and may affect so many of us in so many different ways, claims that are more conventional that currently run afoul of tort law doctrines will seem much more manageable by the courts. I think that's Doug persuasively chronicles the array of obstacles that climate change claims face, and today I just want to suggest that I think that particular scenario seems fairly unlikely, and partly because the non-judiciability issues, and that Doug so ably chronicles. That will serve as obstacles to climate change, and I guess I want to make the argument too that non-judiciability arguments and rulings really sort of preclude the development of litigation, and they sort of stifle the whole common law process, so it's not simply an issue of tweaking the claim in some fashion or presenting a little bit more evidence. A non-judiciability ruling really sort of forecloses that kind of litigation. And here I just want to offer an admittedly somewhat distant analogy from criminal litigation, which was McCleskey v. Kemp, where the United States Supreme Court essentially held that claims of racial discrimination in capital sentencing were non-justiciable. And that ruling all but eliminated efforts to show that such racial discrimination violated the Eighth and 14th Amendment. And so as a result, I think absent a sort of a rich brew of tort claims that bubble up and that change, that make slightly stronger claims and whatnot, a non-judiciability holding is likely to or sort of preclude that entire common law process. In some ways, this is a shame, because I think Doug makes a very powerful critique of what he calls the marginalist bias of tort. And that when tort, as it often does, involves an implicit cost-benefit analysis of some kind, it focuses too much on just the short-run costs and benefits, and doesn't necessarily look at some of the longer-run costs and benefits. I mean, the sort of the history of cost-benefit analysis in tort, sort of conventionally seen in the United States versus Carroll Towing, developed more theoretically and more explicitly by Guido Calabresi and Richard Posner. But it tends to focus on what economists would call the partial equilibrium solution, as opposed to seeking a longer term, more general equilibrium solution. And I think this is a very important point that has not received the attention that it should in tort law. And Doug uses the metaphor of a mountain quite powerfully, I think, in the piece, that tort really helps us inch up the mountain that we're on without helping us determine necessarily if we're on the right mountain in the first place. And an example in the context of driving, we typically would think that a driver might be found to be negligent for driving recklessly, but not necessarily for driving a particular route or driving a heavy car that imposes more risk on others. The cost-benefit analysis, if there is one, focuses on the short-run costs and benefits instead of some of the longer runs. Now, there may be reasons for this. I'll get into those in a second. But there are some real downsides towards myopia or myopia, and particularly it sort of forecloses the possibility that using tort-based market incentives to internalize the externalities, as a number of our commentators have already noted, maybe regulation does this better, but tort can certainly do it as well. And you can make an argument that tort does it in some ways better than regulation. I mean, you don't have the risk of capture. It can be superior to sort of old school command control regulation. And at least there's a coherent vision. It's not one I particularly subscribe to, but one could put together an argument that suggests that tort is in fact superior to conventional regulation. But the larger point is that I think that an insufficient attention has been paid to the sort of the short run marginalist bias that Doug ably critiques in the article. Some of the obstacles, of course, to this sort of far-sighted tort law aren't particularly well developed in the article, and I think are worth restating. They've been touched on today by others. One is the question of democratic legitimacy. Should unelected courts be making these kind of long-term decisions, or are those sort of best left to the democratic processes? You're potentially, depending on the particular instance, you're moving quite away from the quite some distance from the conventional sort of A injures B paradigm. And do we really want the courts telling us what mountain to ascend? I mean, this is the problem, of course, and it's perhaps unfair to Doug's metaphor, but it may be something that we feel is better suited for the rough and tumble of the democratic process. On the other hand, as a practical matter, are faceless bureaucrats making a regulation somewhere any better than courts? I mean, you could certainly argue that in some ways the courts are more responsive than the regulatory process. There's also a question that's related, but I think discrete, of informational competence. And are courts necessary to process the vast amount of information? And here again, if you want courts to look at sort of a longer term set of costs and benefits and really try to seek and identify the long-term equilibrium solution, or at least make rulings with some knowledge of that, you have to have some theory as to why courts are able to process that amount of information. And in general, the longer-term equilibrium solution and identifying that and litigating questions in light of that is going to take more information. And there are real questions as to whether courts are constitutionally and sort of capably, institutionally capable of processing that amount of information. So, what's in sort of the general light of really trying to use this as somewhat of an imaginative jumping off point, not just for climate change, but for tort more generally, what might be a way forward? Well, first is that claims are incredibly diverse, right? I mean, so one of the interesting things about tort and the possible universe of tort claims is that there are so many possible kinds of claims, it's difficult to kind of sort of imagine them from the get-go. And perhaps there is a category of claims that do not raise serious issues about democratic legitimacy or informational competence, and then we're less worried about those. Now, partly because this is a sort of an imaginative exercise, I'm not going to be very specific about what those claims may exactly look like. But I think in general they're likely to be not too far from the sort of A injures B paradigm. And for whatever set of reasons, the information seems within the competence of courts to address. Now, it might be that there's a category of climate changes that meets those criteria. I'm certainly not sure, but if they are, that's likely to be the case where climate change is a relevant fact rather than the underlying tortious act. So rather than trying to litigate climate change on a nuisance theory where you're really trying to make a very ambitious global claim, it may be that there are a subset of claims that are very much related to climate change, but that are much more modest and perhaps deal with appropriate preparations for upcoming climate change. And it may be that those are the category of claims that can move tort gradually through the common law process, rather than these sort of more ambitious, more global claims. But I guess I finally want to leave everyone with Yogi Berra, and it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future.
Great. Well, I'll try to be real short. I mean, it seemed like there was a consensus on the panel that a legislative or a regulatory solution to greenhouse gas emissions reduction is preferable to the tort system, and I agree with that consensus, and that's why I'm happy I didn't argue otherwise in the paper. I think it's important that the cases lose for the right reason. I think it's very important that they lose for the right reason. And so you take, like, it's unfortunate that the Connecticut AEP case was the one that went up to the Supreme Court, because in some ways that one and the Comer case are far less well pled than the Kivalina case. The Kivalina case was carefully crafted to sort of avoid some of the political question intractability that almost was led, you know, as a chin by the other two cases. So in Kivalina, you know, we basically have a landowner that is bearing a disproportionate burden for the benefits of greenhouse gas emissions that we've all enjoyed over the last couple of centuries. And so they were trying to invoke an older understanding of trespass and nuisance doctrine, in which you're not trying to say that the defendant's activity fail a cost-benefit test. That's a regulatory way of thinking about it. You're instead trying to say that you have suffered a discrete and significant harm as a result of those activities that should be compensated, irrespective of whether society on net is better off for them having emitted the pollutant, right? And that's bread and butter adjudication. That's classical tort adjudication. And so it shouldn't appear to judges as exotic or radioactive or otherwise intractable, at least in that dimension. Now, I still think the causation, the proximate causation issue in Kivalina is intractable. I mean, they're able to muster at most like 1.8% of annual emissions among the defendant class, and that just seems to stretch the idea of market share liability to a breaking point. I mean, that really does raise fairness concerns of the sort that David mentioned. A better case, I think, this is basically the point I'm trying to make about, against the backdrop of climate change, more garden variety cases that are still dismissed right now might come to seem a little more palatable. So there's a case called Verasich, which followed Hurricane Katrina, in which some landowners sued oil and gas companies for their exploration activities, which had chewed up the wetlands, and therefore enhanced the amount of damage that Katrina caused. And this was a really well-pled, interesting case, because they were only seeking damages for the enhanced amount of suffering that was attributable to the diminished wetland storm surge protection that had been lost after the canals were dug there. And the court dismissed it by saying that tort law duties only apply between, quote, neighbors under Louisiana state law, and that neighbors concept was interpreted in really kind of classical, narrow, geographic kinds of terms. And I think one thing climate helps us understand is that we are neighbors in other ways than merely that. We are neighbors via the ecological processes that bind us all together in so many ways. And as that becomes more and more kind of salient in our consciousness, a case like Verasich may no longer feel quite as exotic. And I think I'll just stop there so we have some time for back and forth.
Thank you. David,
before
you leave, do you want to add anything?
I still think that even though I would agree Kivalina is framed more narrowly than the other cases have been, and the plaintiffs have presented it as almost as though it's a simple trespass case. The ocean's washing up on our shore, and the reason the ocean is washing up on our shore is because you've emitted carbon dioxide. The problem is, though, that there's still a pretty attenuated chain of logic to work your way through, and that's what every district judge who's seen one of these things is struggling with. And it's not just in the nuisance cases, it's also been in judicial review of federal agency action cases. The BLM case out in New Mexico and the defense fuel supply case here in the Eastern District of Virginia, they're looking at them and saying, this is just extraordinarily complicated thinking that I'm not comfortable trying to address. That's sort of number one. And number two I come back to is the whole question of the foreign emitters. And when you start deciding how much is too much or how much is okay, you inevitably find your way into that. And that's why the regulatory process, I say, is far more suitable to them. Thank you very much.
Hey, I have a quick question. Don't mind. While we have Yogi up here, can you predict where you think things are 5-10 years down the road, both on the board side and on the regulatory side? Do you have a sense of that, given that it's some regulation?
I will certainly defer to David and colleagues about where he thinks the politics are going 5 years from now. I'd certainly be interested in the thing. I'll call Las Vegas after I hear what he has to say. I think the tort litigation probably is going to end in the next couple of years. I think that's my prediction. But, you know, I certainly want to hedge their plans back. That's certainly what they would hope it is. And as I said, I think it's the game is the existing Clean Air Act, as David said, and beyond that, and you know, we need other solutions. It's a combination of U.S. legislation and back to the bargaining table in the international convention. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
David.
The other maybe you have.
Well, I think one of the fairness points that David raised. It's certainly different if you're using joint and several liability and sticking, defendants responsible for 1.8% of the pollution with the total bill. That's different than if you stuck them with 1.8% of the bill, you know, some sort of proportional liability, and then the plaintiffs would be told, in effect, well, you know, you can only, it's tough that you can't get relief from U.S. courts from defendants over which they don't have jurisdiction, but we can give you relief for those over which we do have jurisdiction. So, I mean, I think you can find your way through the fairness of that. There are some ways in which the proof problems involved in the climate change problem are simpler than they are in A to B cases. If you're thinking back on the Woburn case, the plaintiffs there had to show that stuff leaked out of an underground waste site and traveled through groundwater pathways that no one can see, directly from A to a specific point B, which is where they lived and where their wells were getting contaminated. I don't know anything more about that case than what I just said, but it does seem to me that it's very complicated to show what happens directionally underground. It's quite complicated to show what happens directionally in above ground in air pollution cases. You know, I mean, where Georgia had to show that the pollution hurting its forests was coming from the Tennessee Copper Company. Climate change, the problem is much simplified because, like cream in your coffee, it's equally distributed a minute after you pour it in. You don't have to worry about tracing all those plumes in the first 30 seconds while it's mixing around. Again, if you combine that with proportionality, it's pretty easy to say that a power company's responsibility for anyone's damages is proportional to the fraction of their emissions. So there are a lot of these tort problems, proof problems, I think, and attribution problems that are not at all intractable if one would just get beyond these, as Doug says, the super structure of doctrines that have been used to try to fence fence the courts from having to deal with these with the traditions.
All right, questions? Leslie?
Get over the actual causation hurdle for a number of different climate harms. There's a whole new science of climate attribution that's almost tailor-made to suit plaintiffs' lawyers. It's that, you know, you come up with findings like the European heat wave that caused 30,000 deaths was eight times more likely to have occurred because of the human contribution to climate change. So that's our standard for proof. The problem is that then how do you figure out which are the right defendants? And the strategy from the plaintiff's perspective is to scale up the defendant so you can kind of attribute a larger and larger share of emissions to that entity. So that's why we pick corporate entities. You know, we'd sue national governments if we could. And in fact, the nation of Palau is trying to bring an ICJ court case to establish as international law liability principles what nations are responsible for. But the problem there is still that you're still left with these intractable questions about, well, the Kivalina defendants, do we attribute all the emissions that they are kind of associated with? Do we attribute Exxon's exploration emissions? Also, do we attribute the end product? When I put Exxon gas in my car and burn it, are those my emissions or Exxon's emissions? You know, those kinds of questions are utterly unresolved. The Kivalina plaintiffs, again, went with the most narrowly defensible version of it. They only went with direct exploration and activity emissions of the fossil fuel companies, not the fossil fuel product itself. But still, you have questions like, well, the reason these harms are happening is because we eliminated our headroom over the last 200 years. And, you know, the Exxon's emissions didn't become as harmful until, you know, because of that headroom already being chewed up. And when does, you know, let's think about Sienter, right? When does the knowledge requirement kick in that your emissions now are eliminating headroom and causing processes that are gonna result in concrete harms? I think all of those questions are utterly intractable, but I think it's important that courts be forced to grapple with them. Even if their answer is to say, you know, 1.8% is not enough for us even to use market, like, court. When courts are forced to give those answers, they are couching the kind of moral primitives of climate change in this dignified pedigreed discourse that we've had for 800 years now, and I think that's important.
What is the value? In other words, if you have a claim and the court just says this is not justiciable, we're not going to hear this. I mean, what's the
So when the city of Cincinnati, like a number of municipalities, sued the subprime mortgage industry and tried to say that that industry created the public nuisance of blighted neighborhoods from underwater mortgages, the district court judge in that case didn't just use political question or one of these easy, like, duck moves. The district court judge instead engaged in a very detailed substantive analysis of Ohio state tort law and found that under the public nuisance doctrine there, there's a defense for elaborately regulated and permitted activities. It's essentially like a preemption displacement kind of analysis that already existed within the quite sensible common law. But what it forced the court to do was point the finger exactly where in the governmental system our representatives failed us. Which agencies weren't implementing their regulations, or which regulations weren't crafted in a way that was tight enough to prevent that disaster. And I think that's really valuable intra-governmental feedback, that kind of that finger-pointing information development. I think it's hard to kind of concretely trace the causality and say, yeah, here's the benefit. But in fact, that was part of the founder's design, was precisely to have that hydraulics available.
Sometimes it comes out, you know, after some delay. Apparently there's an article in the Wall Street Journal today attributing the Titanic disaster to a failure of the regulators to enforce rules for the number of lifeboats that were supposed to be on boats at that time. So now we know.
Now, yeah. Dan?
Well, I'm pleased to hear that it may take 100 years, but eventually the Wall Street Journal will recognize.
Yeah. Yeah, if I may comment on the standing issue in the regulatory context, I think it's extremely worrisome that this is a question, a serious question. I mean, it's a good thing that the Supreme Court has resolved that aggrieved states can bring these cases. But there is still a question of whether a citizens group can do so on behalf of its members all by itself. And when Congress passed the Clean Air Act or any of these regulatory laws, the drafters, they were very conscious of the fact that one of the checks on agency capture was the ability of both sides, the industrial side and the citizen side, to go before neutral courts and argue that the law had been misinterpreted or the facts had been arbitrarily ignored. And the standing doctrines, if it should play out that citizen groups don't have standing because they're unlike normal air pollution, you know, where you can point to a member who's downstream and is breathing something that is asthma enhancing, so we get standing. If no one can do that for global warming just because everybody is diffusely and equivalently harmed, then the implementation of the regulatory system has been fundamentally unbalanced because one could argue that one of the things that's, there's two things that are different about environmental law than maybe previous iterations of regulatory law, namely that there is an organized, there are organized representatives of the beneficiaries, NRDC, Sierra Club, groups like ours, many, many, many local groups who care and who speak up politically and have some weight in the political process. But it's also important that they have some weight in the judicial supervision of these laws. And so that absent that, absent the citizen supervisions and citizen standing provided in the Clean Air Act, you would have seen the EPA become a creature of the industry, regulated industries, to a much greater extent and at a much greater speed. Now there are revivals, and they're driven by macro politics like the election of presidents who have a political base for caring about the environmental laws, but it's also more consistently because there are courts who will slap the agencies down during periods of other presidents for failure to implement the law. If we lose that balance, then the legal authority to regulate greenhouse gases may turn out to be hollow if there's no one who can hold the agencies to account.
One more question?
Global, although the paper is very focused on domestic U.S. law, but the global implications are important. You know, from my perspective, for the better part of 20 years, international negotiations have been severely held back by the confusion, ambivalence, and sometimes doublespeak that characterizes the U.S. negotiating position. And partly that's just because we are a intentionally fragmented and plurivocal democracy. And so whatever the executive says is not necessarily what the Senate's going to do. And so the reason I was excited about Connecticut versus AEP was that it was acting as a gun to the head of the EPA for EPA to implement the Clean Air Act. And EPA's threatened implementation of the Clean Air Act was acting as a gun to the head of Congress to actually take seriously something like Waxman-Markey or putting a price on carbon. And what that would have done is clarified the U.S. position. It would have gotten us in a position where the rest of the world can now get serious about a harmonized international framework. So when the Supreme Court in the AEP case decided that displacement analysis was a purely formal gesture, right? Did Congress write a statute that happened to mention this issue? And we don't care how comprehensive it was, we don't care how rigorous it was, we don't care how directly it related to the alleged harm being brought before the court. We don't care how the EPA is doing in terms of implementing. It made it a purely formal check-the-box analysis. By doing that, the court took the gun away, right? It took away that piece of leverage that would have helped EPA by diminishing some of the opposition EPA faces from the industry. because industry can connect the dots and see, well, I'd rather not end up with tort suits. So I'm gonna, and I really don't want the Clean Air Act, so let me go back to Congress. But all of that would have been good, and instead the Supreme Court disempowered itself from the hydraulic conversation.
Good point. So before we take our non Steve Beecher, who is the managing editor of Valpartisan, is going to close us out here, and then
yeah, very quick. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But I'd like to thank first everybody in attendance for joining us today. This was really, really excellent. And again, to all of our panelists, I'd like to give a hand just everybody. Everybody that involved, we couldn't have really asked for a better series of panels. Again, to our contributing authors, Professors Dan Farber, Doug Kaiser, and Jonathan Adler. To our panelists, Alexander Golub, Michael Gu, Gordon Wu, Tim Brennan, Larry Cooper, James Anderson, David Buente, David Doniger, and Ellen Peter. Another thanks to John Cruden and ELI for co-sponsoring the event, and again to Senator Udall for arranging for this wonderful room. As we mentioned throughout the day, we have initial drafts of all of the comments and articles available outside on your way out, and we'd like you to visit our website at vanderbilt.edu. law.vanderbilt.edu for more information and for ultimately an audio recording and a transcript of today's event and more information generally about LPAR along with our trend tracking that Professor Vandenberg mentioned earlier today. Again, so thank you all of you for attending and enjoy the weekend. It's going to be an unseasonably warm one once again. Thank you.